I'm Mark Golub. And in the news, continuing protests throughout the country, led by Black Lives Matter, critical of America in general, and of American police departments in particular, for being guilty of systemic racism. There are certain things virtually all of the American people agree on. There's no disagreement that the heinous murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis policeman is inexcusable, unacceptable, and that all four of the policemen should wind up in jail. There's also no disagreement that police brutality has absolutely no place in America and must be rooted out anywhere it exists. And there's also no disagreement that in America, no one should be denied freedom of opportunity or any freedom guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States, and that the playing field of life should be as fair as humanly possible. And in that context, many, if not most, Americans understand there are still inequities in this country which need to be addressed and corrected, that the United States is not a perfectly just utopian society, and that Americans of color, especially African Americans, often have a more difficult time achieving what white Americans can achieve. At the same time, many Americans do not agree that the United States is systemically racist, or for that matter, that the police of America as a group is systemically racist. By the way, these issues are of extreme importance to the American Jewish community. First, because Jews care about the quality of life of others. And when people are persecuted or brutalized or prevented from achieving a decent manner of living, Jews are always in the forefront of social programs and reforms. That's why Jews were so prominent in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, symbolized by the sacrifice of Michael Schwerner and Andrew Goodman, murdered alongside James Chaney, and symbolized by Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel's walking arm in arm with Martin Luther King Jr. And the second reason this issue is so important to American Jewry is because Jews have thrived in America as we have nowhere else in Jewish history because of the uniqueness of this noble social experiment. A commitment to the principle of freedom and justice for all, and because of the innate goodness of the American system and of the American people, as flawed as both the system and the people may be. At the moment, that's not the message being conveyed by those leading the protests throughout the country. To the contrary, their message is that America is grounded in racism and is systemically racist today. Well, while it's always good to hear from rabbis and Jewish leaders on matters of social importance, in this instance, it's also most important to hear from someone in the African American community. And so on this edition of In the News, I have the honor of speaking with a man, Peter N. Kersenow, a distinguished member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, a position he was recently reappointed to for a fourth consecutive six-year term by House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Peter Kersenow is also a lawyer specializing in labor and employment law with a firm in Cleveland, Ohio, and he has served as a member of the National Labor Relations Board. And Peter, thank you so much for joining us on JBS.
Thanks so much for your outstanding opening. I wish I could have done it myself, and thank you for inviting me on this show.
That is so lovely of you to say. By the way, I want to ask you one general question to place you for our audience. Peter, how do you self-define yourself on the American political spectrum?
I would say I'm conservative to libertarian.
And has that been true your whole life?
Yes, it has been, although I've been a Democrat for most of my life. When I finally realized where the Democratic Party was going, which was completely different from where I was at the time and where it eventually ended up, I decided to become a Republican.
You heard how I sort of framed where we are in America today. I want to know from you, from your perspective, Peter, is America systemically racist? And is the police departments of America, are they systemically racist?
I would say unequivocally no. I know that's not a popular position to hold if you come from the black community. I live in inner city Cleveland, have been for the last 40 years of my life. I'm in the same neighborhood for the last 40 years of my life. And unfortunately, it seems as if there is a narrative that you have to adopt if you're black. There's a signed set of beliefs, and if you depart from those beliefs, then you're not sufficiently black. But the fact of the matter is that, as you said in your intro, the narrative that has been developed and promulgated for the last couple of weeks at least, but it's something that predates the George Floyd incident, is that America is systemically racist, that it is almost irretrievably racist, that it, the stain on the founding of slavery has somehow been indelible and you can never remove it. In my nearly 20 years on the Civil Rights Commission, I've seen significant progress. During my lifetime, I've seen significant progress. During my lifetime, it was lawful to discriminate against blacks and other races on the basis of race in employment and in housing. That changed. That didn't remedy the problem, but we've made extraordinary progress. To the extent there's any systemic racism, there are certain areas of society where there is clear discrimination on the basis of race. But contrary to what many in the media and on the left are talking about, because they would be hard-pressed to find any evidence of racism, that racism goes in favor of, quote-unquote, people of color. That occurs in educational institutions most readily, where if you're black, you are at some schools up to 500 times, not 5%, but up to 500 times more likely to be admitted into a college over a similarly situated white or Asian comparative. In fact, it's very similar in many places to the type of exclusions and discrimination practiced against Jews prior to the 1960s. You know, I went to an Ivy League school. Most Ivy League schools affirmatively discriminated against Jews. Today, there is a pending lawsuit. It's currently at the Court of Appeals, Students for Fair Admissions, Asian students bringing suit against Harvard because they're being discriminated against. That is happening throughout the country, and that discrimination, again, heavily favors blacks and Hispanics. Also, in employment, yes, there's discrimination from time to time, but in terms of systemic discrimination, it is unquestionable that many companies, thousands of companies, especially the larger ones, but lots of companies and institutions across the country actively seek out black and Hispanic employees. They reach out to them in a more aggressive fashion. It's not systemic racism. It's truly an affirmative action, but standards are lowered because there's a desperation to have a more inclusive workforce. That's what you hear about all the time. This notion that somehow there's pervasive discrimination, systemic discrimination in the land against blacks is completely contradicted by the evidence. We have EEOC data, which shows a continuing decline in discrimination cases, and those are individual discrimination cases. Sure, there are class action cases brought from time to time, and my point is, as you stated at the outset, we have not eliminated racism or discrimination in this country. But to the extent anyone is claiming there's systemic racism, they are completely wrong.
So many questions come up as a result of what you've just said. Why do you think it is that the people who are protesting, what is driving them, Peter, is a feeling that their fellow human beings who are of color, especially African American, are being in some way brutalized, that they don't have the same kind of opportunity or rights, and they describe things that happen to them because they are African American? And by the way, I meant to ask you, Peter, have you ever been stopped by a policeman? And have you ever been stopped by a policeman, do you think, because you're black?
You know, I've been asked that question a lot. And I heard my friend Tim Scott say that he has been stopped at least 7 times that he believes on the basis of race. In my lifetime, and I'm 66 years old, I can only look to one occasion in which that was plausibly the case. I'm not saying it's never happened to anybody else. I have not been in somebody else's car or in somebody else's shoes. But to me, there was only one occasion, and I've been stopped more than once, but for good reason, because I was violating traffic laws. But there was one occasion when I was going back to school where I was stopped, and it was, frankly, an anodyne situation. It was not a big deal. I was speeding. I was legitimately stopped, but I asked why it was that they stopped me because they didn't give me a ticket. And one of the two officers said, because we got a report that of a crime, and you looked like somebody in that report, or the description in that report, which didn't seem plausible because I got stopped for speeding because I was going more than 70 miles an hour. There's no way they could have identified who I was, except that this was in upstate New York, mostly white, and if they saw a black guy, that would be unusual, and maybe they got a report of somebody black. I don't know. I don't like ascribing, you know, bad motives to people if I don't have hard evidence, but that's the only time I can think of. I'm not excusing of those occasions which it may have happened to others, but it hasn't really happened to me.
I understand, and I was really asking you, when you look at those who are in the streets, if they're good people and they're doing something they believe is important to make life better for African Americans, where are they wrong from your perspective?
That's a very good question. It's a question that isn't asked often enough. I get interviewed on the radio and on television with some frequency, and there's a narrative that almost everyone has adopted. It's unchallenged. It is something that is almost an article of faith. Almost every interviewer, almost every college student I've talked to, and they all believe that there is systemic racism as you've described it. They have, frankly, I think, adopted a view of America that may have been the case decades ago, not even years ago, but decades ago, but things have changed significantly. And here's where the narrative is false. There are dueling narratives that I think sparked these riots. As horrific as the video was of Mr. Floyd and the kneeling on him, and then there's the other video of Ahmaud Arbery being chased down and gunned down. One narrative is that police officers are disproportionately targeting blacks and shooting them. And the other narrative is, as I think at least one person had tweeted at one point, that racist whites are hunting down blacks. It's not that something like that never happens, but they are vanishingly rare, and it's contrary to the data we see. I doubt that there would be rioting if it just occurred, as horrific as it is, to Mr. Floyd or Mr. Aubrey. The perception is, as you indicated, is this is something that happens with great frequency and, in fact, increasing frequency. There's nothing further from the truth. There are significant reports and studies done by this, and not by right-wing extremists, reports from Harvard, from the National Academy of Sciences, all manner of reports, and the data is derived from multiple sources to check against any kind of biases. You get uniform crime data, the National Victimhood Survey, many of different surveys. It's not perfect, but this is close to a complete data set as you can get. And the data shows as follows, contrary to the perception that blacks are being hunted down or are being disproportionately shot by cops, white perpetrators or white suspects in one data set are slightly more likely to be shot by cops than blacks, similarly situated blacks are. In another data set, whites are twice as likely to be shot. Again, not 5%, not 10%, not 20%, twice as likely to be shot. There's not a whole lot of analysis as to why that is, but my own hunch, based on everything I've seen over the years, is that white cops, let me back up, I apologize for that. There's one more piece of data you should look at, and that is that there's at least one study that shows that black cops are 3.3 times more likely to shoot a black suspect than white cops are. And I think one of the reasons for that is, again, a hunch, but I think it's a reasonable one, is that cops in general, but particularly white cops, have seen what happens if they shoot somebody, and you could have something like a Michael Brown incident with hands up, don't shoot in Ferguson, turned out to be completely wrong. There was no such thing like that. But Darren Wilson, where is he today? A lot of cops have seen what's happened to other cops when this happens, and they're reluctant to pull their service weapon in a confrontation like that. But it's even deeper than that. This idea that blacks are being disproportionately shot by cops doesn't take into consideration black involvement in crime. Blacks are actually underrepresented significantly in these types of police shootings relative to black overrepresentation in crime, and particularly violent crime. In addition, blacks are overrepresented among the cohort who will be involved in a shooting confrontation with cops where they initiated it. As an example, blacks are 18.5 times more likely to shoot and kill a cop than a cop is likely to shoot and kill an unarmed black man. Blacks are, forgive me on this data, I used to know it off the top of my head, but black males are several times, I think it's 2.8 times, more likely to shoot a cop than a white male is. The data go on and on like this. I mean, and some of the disparities are truly astonishing. Even for somebody like me, who's been looking at this data for two decades, every once in a while you see data points that are remarkable. And it doesn't give me any pleasure as a black man to say this, but truth and accuracy are important. And if you give me a moment, I'll tell you precisely why it is, other Please than do. The independent value of truth and
accuracy.
And when you take a look at the data with respect to who is being hunted or who is being hurt in violent interracial incidences, it's really an amazing stat. Blacks represent 13.4% of the population in the United States, but are responsible for 85.5% of violent interracial crimes. And from a numerical perspective, other than a mere percentage perspective, that translates to, during the four-year period 2012-2015, there were approximately 540,000 violent interracial assaults by blacks on whites. There are approximately 70,000 assaults by whites against blacks. So that disparity is significant. We're talking nearly a half a million, or 450,000 more black assaults on whites than vice versa. That undercuts the narrative that blacks are under siege. It's the narrative that is fueling all of these riots, because there's this feeling as if blacks are disproportionately, again, as it may have been 50 years ago or 60 years ago, subjected to police abuse. Here's why that matters independently of the discrete value of truth and accuracy. And that is, if black lives matter, if you're concerned about black lives, you don't want that prevailing narrative to take hold, because I'll give you just one example. And this is a syndrome that occurs, and it's well established now. After the 2014 Michael Brown incident in Ferguson, Missouri, where it was falsely stated that an unarmed, peaceful black man put up his hands and said, you know, don't shoot. Now we find out that was completely false. But after that, in all of the uproar surrounding that, there was a curbing of police forces. A number of police departments engaged in consent decrees with the Department of Justice that, for lack of a better term, bound their hands. I'm not saying that some of these weren't merited, but police, because of the uproar surrounding this and what they saw happen to Darren Wilson and a reluctance to be involved in something like that themselves, withdrew from active policing. And the results were catastrophic for the black community. In my Cleveland neighborhood and all of Cleveland, we had slightly more than a 30-year decline in violent crimes. And that's something that occurred throughout the country. It was extraordinary, and it was very welcome. The year after the Michael Brown incident, we had a spike in crime, and that spike wasn't 2% or 3% as might happen on an annualized basis. The spike in homicide alone was 90%. In the 50 largest cities throughout the country, the spike was in the double digits. I saw most recently, and I don't know that you can this quickly attribute a so-called Ferguson effect to the current riots, but you saw what happened in Chicago recently where they set a record for the most murders in one day. I believe it was 18 in one day.
Yes.
Also, a couple of days ago, I saw the stats from Los Angeles where they had a 250 percentage point spike in overall crime. This is not a coincidence. And who gets hurt? In the main, it's blacks who are getting hurt. So it's important to have an honest narrative for the sake of the truth, but also for the sake of Black Lives Mattering. And the idea that we should be defunding police forces or abolishing them at this time, again, in my neighborhood, if police disappear, there's going to be some serious, serious problems. Not all police are angels. There are bad cops. But there are usually about 11 million arrests every year, okay? You have racist cops. There are racist dentists, I suppose. They're probably racist grocery store owners. It's more serious if you've got a racist cop because of the potential consequences. But thankfully, they are few and far between. And thankfully, many police departments have adequate training, but not enough. If you want to reform police departments' training, fund them some more. Make sure you vet them at the outset. But to the extent you vilify cops, make it more difficult and disfavorable to become a cop, you're not going to get the best and the brightest to be cops, and you're probably going to be exacerbating the situation rather than helping the situation.
That was so helpful. Peter, I'm going to ask you something that sounds disrespectful. I don't mean it in any disrespectful way.
I have a feeling I know. I get this question all the time. Go ahead.
You know where I'm going?
I think I do.
Okay. Peter, inside the African-American community, would you hear people say to you, Peter, you're an Uncle Tom?
Yeah. I'm asked that question by interviewers quite often, and I'll tell you something. It's something because I've seen others being called that, I would expect. I may be one of the most fortunate black guys in America. They may say it, but not to my face. I've been fortunate that no one's ever said to my face, because I'm not sure how I would react. I mean, I'm an old guy, but everyone has, you know, a certain sense of themselves. But no, I'm sure it's being said behind my back, because again, the prevailing narrative is difficult to dislodge. If I believed the narrative and I heard somebody say something contrary to the narrative, I would think unfavorable, or I'd be looking at him disfavorably also. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that there are a lot of people out there who, when they hear what I say, it's like cold water in their face. And also, there's this view, and look, there are people who have been harmed by police interactions, and you could probably point to somebody that you know who has been roughed up.
Exactly.
Okay? Exactly. So But that doesn't translate into universal policy.
Exactly.
Everyone's being done that way.
What you say is so important. You just understand it flies. Your narrative flies in the face of everything that's going on in city after city after city in America. And you understand, I'm a rabbi. I deal with Jews all the time. I deal with Jews of all ages all the time. I also, you know, am on JBS all the time. I receive emails from everybody. And there are Jews who are convinced that America is, in fact, racist. They look at the poverty that and the squalor and, you know, the kind of scenes we see in the old series, The Wire. I don't know if you saw The Wire, where they portrayed Baltimore, the projects and the towers and the drug culture. And, you know, lovely black people were, number one, just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And they were also victimized by other blacks in the community. And there were shootings all the time. And black children would be shot and by accident. And mothers had to put their children into bathtubs to protect them at times from wild bullets flying all over the place. And there is a sense among those who are in the streets that that is what the African-American community is experiencing today, and that you, Peter, are the anomaly. You obviously, some way, I don't know, I should have asked you, by the way, to tell us one little thing about your own personal family background, how you end up being who you are and being a member of the United States Civil Rights Commission and sitting on the National Labor Board and having a position of responsibility in the Cleveland community. Are you, you know, a complete anomaly, or are you representative of many, both in terms of opportunity and in terms of real life? But that's the, you know, as you said, many people are going to be upset by what you say, because the general notion, the Al Sharptons of your community are saying the reason why blacks have not been more successful, have not been in more positions of responsibility, do not have the same kind of economic stations that white Americans is because of a white knee on the neck of the African American. That's the narrative today, Peter, and it is going to be very surprising, and many people, by the way, Peter, they just, no matter what evidence you have, no matter what facts you have, no matter what stats you have, they'll refuse to accept right. Your perspective.
Yeah, I am not an anomaly, and I understand why people think that, because there's been a prevailing narrative for a number of reasons that would take us an hour to talk about. Some of them are political reasons. There's a political imperative to maintaining this false narrative. And also, we have a history in this country. I mean, the history was not a good history, but we're talking about today. We're talking about the last 30 years, for example. If you're being honest, again, it's important. And I check myself every time to look at data, to rethink how I've come to conclusions. But if you're being honest, you take a look at the fact that there's one data point, and I keep talking about data. It's not just a matter of numbers. A lot of it is a matter of common sense and what we've seen in terms of historical, cultural history. Today, 2020 America, it's not 1965 Selma, Alabama, okay? It's not perfect. Because of the human condition, it likely never will be perfect. But it's never been a better time to be an American, to be a Black American, Hispanic American, Asian American, Jewish American. But we've got all of these forces allied against one another that are ripping us apart. And it's based on a false premise. Here's the one thing, and it's very simple, but it's simple, but extraordinarily difficult to do, or extraordinarily difficult to exhort people to do. Virtually every disparity between blacks and similarly situated whites disappears entirely if the black person does two things. The child of that black person, if a father marries the mother of his child and makes sure that child graduates from high school, those two things, virtually every disparity disappears. Every single one. Politicians, media people, cultural tastemakers refuse to say that. Not only do you sound like a scold, but you sound harsh. And because, unfortunately, our culture has changed to lionize, or maybe even lionize may not be the right word. In fact, it may be that to look upon marriage as some kind of archaic institution. But the fact of the matter is that look at married black people and their progeny, similarly situated, hardly any difference that you can discern between blacks and whites. That's a very unpopular thing to say. It's a lot easier for a lot of folks to blame some externality rather than their own poor choices for their condition. And I know if you said that, you'd get considerable blowback. I get considerable blowback all the time for saying that. And I'm, you know, that's just the way it's got to be. Until such time as there is clear evidence that, in fact, this is 1965 Selma, Alabama, to this point, I will look at all the evidence that shows that we have every piece of civil rights legislation to protect the interests of blacks that possibly could be passed has already been passed, and most of it was passed 40 to 50 years ago. Every company in this country of any size goes out of its way to hire, recruit, and hire black employees, goes out of its way to retain black employees, goes out of its way to make sure that if there are layoffs, that's being done in a precise scientific fashion so that company, among other things, even if they didn't care about blacks, whites in between, don't get hit with disparate impact lawsuits. Now, there are companies that may discriminate on the basis of race every now and then, but it's not any remotely close to being systemic. If anything, as I said before, if there's any overt and systemic racism, it's in order to, it's an affirmative action type of racism to help increase the number of minorities within an institution.
By any chance, do you have a family of your own?
I've got two kids and they're doing extremely well. Again, I'm married to my wife. You know, it's a difficult thing, as every parent knows, to raise kids, even if you've got a partner. I mean, my wife, also attorney, MBA. Yeah, we did extremely well. My father was a steel worker. My mother cleaned houses for a living. My wife's father was a mailman, and her mother was a housekeeper. Okay, we were not privileged at all, but we worked extremely hard. We were fortunate, and we made a go of it. We got married, made sure we remained married, and our kids are prospering as a result.
How old are your kids?
Well, I'm an old man now, so my daughter's 40, my son is 36.
Okay. If your 40-year-old or your 36-year-old was out in the streets of Cleveland or less, well, I don't know where they live, but doesn't matter. If they were in the streets right now, what would your message be to them?
I would refrain from saying that here on this program, Rabbi, but it would not be charitable. I would say to them, protest injustices, yes, no problem. But get off the street if you're going to be associating with people who are tearing down this great country, because you're being afforded more opportunities here than you would any other place. You can prosper more readily here than any other place. This is an imperfect country by every measure, but it's the most perfect country in the history of the world.
Do you have any sense, by the way, about how Black Lives Matter as it's becoming sort of the leading institution right now in the African-American community, what its goals are? And I'm also going to ask you in a moment if you know anything about how they feel vis-a-vis Israel and the Jewish people. But speak to me in general, in the context that you've given us, What's your feeling about Black Lives Matter, which at the moment is, again, the darling of the media? And they may be doing a lot of good, but I want to hear it from you.
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I know everything in the world about Black Lives Matter. Obviously, on the Civil Rights Commission, you do take a look at these things. And the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement may have had, some good ideas and intentions. But if you take a look at certain aspects of Black Lives Matter, you've got to be very honest about it. They were maybe, there was some overt anti-Semitic aspects to Black Lives Matter. I don't know if that continues, but there were at the outset. The way it's constituted and the way it approaches things is something that is almost a top-down structure and is, put this way, it's almost the obverse of the Martin Luther King movement. It is a very imperious movement, and it intimidates folks of every race. And again, it is based on that false premise. Its origin had to do with the false premise of the Michael Brown incident, and it perpetuates the false narrative. It is, by doing so, it is harming more blacks than it is helping for the reasons I outlined earlier. So I think the portrait of Black Lives Matter in the media is far more favorable than what the outcome of the Black Lives Matter movement is causing to the black community.
When you hear people say, when you hear American politicians say that the police department are engaged in genocide of the African-American community, or that being black is a death sentence in America. And we've heard both of these, Peter, during this period of time. I know you've sort of spoken this again. Yeah. I don't need a long answer from you. But when you hear that, how do you, as an African-American, feel?
As an American, I'm upset. As a human being, I'm upset because it's irresponsible hyperbole to be charitable. Now, keep this in mind. I think there are people who sincerely ascribe to the Black Lives Matter movement because Black Lives Matter. But there is a significant cohort within that movement that seems to be apparently only concerned about Black lives if Black lives suffer as the result of white or police misconduct. Because we don't hear any eruption. Remember the narrative I said was false? The narrative really is that blacks aren't being hunted down by cops. They're not being hunted down by whites. 7,000 plus blacks are killed every year, murdered every year in this country. The number varies a little bit. Of those 7,000, the overwhelming majority are killed by other blacks. In Chicago last weekend, I don't know how many were killed, but almost everybody was black. Same in over every other major city. Hardly ever by cops. But do you see riots about that? No, you don't. Do you see much concern about that? No, you don't. That's not to say that we shouldn't be particularly upset when the state, by means of the police, take a life. That is something that's different, but the numbers are extraordinary. I can't tell you off the top of my head the exact number of blacks, unarmed blacks, who were shot by cops last year. I think it was 9. Okay, 9 were killed. 9 unarmed blacks were killed, and I think
that is correct. Some say 9, some say 10, but it's between 9 and 15 to be sure.
Right. The Washington Post played with those numbers a little bit and tried to add a few more, but 9 or 15, horrible, too many dead, okay? But 7,000 others were killed, mainly by other blacks, and there was no protests about that. And this has been going on every year, no protests about that. Black Lives Matter didn't say anything about that. So with that type of disparity, I think it's justified in asking, What's your ultimate goal here? Is it truly to save black lives, because you're missing all the black lives who are way over here being killed by other blacks? I don't know if this is true, but I saw a tweet, but I could fully believe it to be true. I saw a tweet by someone who purports to be a black physician. He's a trauma surgeon who has been an attending surgeon for approximately a dozen years, I think it was. And he said during that period of time, he's had 67 black males expire on the operating table from gunshot wounds. And I don't know how he knows this. If this is true, he says not one of them died at the hand of a white police officer or a white person. Now, again, that may simply be an anecdote. It might even be apocryphal. May not be true, but the data itself say that it is clearly believable, because almost everybody who is murdered and is black in this country is murdered by another black man. So if you're concerned about black lives, number one, you wouldn't want to defund the police because of the data I gave you with respect to what happens when police withdraw from active policing. And number two, you'd be equally concerned about the taking of any life, black, white, indifferent, by anybody, cop, other black person. Life is life. It's precious. And we shouldn't be playing these racial games, these racial division games. But a lot of people, it seems to me, are very invested in playing these racial games and have been for a long time. Yes, this country had an initial founding that was stained. Yes, there was discrimination throughout much of our history. That has changed, and it's time to acknowledge that's changed so that you can come up with the correct prescriptions for bringing about better opportunities and improvement in the conditions of the black community.
Peter, you're an attorney. You've also been, for years and years, your fourth term on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. There is there's a documentary right now on Netflix. It's called The 13th. It refers to the 13th Amendment. It talks about the fact that ultimately everybody is free in America and everybody can vote, unless you're a criminal. If you're a convicted felon, you lose your rights. The film, the documentary on Netflix, is arguing that that provision in the 13th Amendment, that it excludes felons, was a way for white America to keep African Americans as unpaid slaves. They became slaves, but through the justice system, that once they were arrested, they were put on work details, and in addition, if they ever got out of jail, they were stripped already of their American rights, especially the right to vote and to be a citizen. To what extent do you feel there is truth to that documentary on Netflix?
Rabbi, let me preface it by saying that I'm aware of that. I've looked at it. I even commented about it on a PBS station, in fact, dealing with the civil rights amendments of the 1800s. Having said that, I know my limitations. I don't know that I know enough to say one way or the other, but what I can tell you is, based on my own research and what I know, the obverse is true. That is, it was not done to keep blacks in some form of indentured servitude or anything else like that. Again, within my limitations, which are probably not that great, admittedly. I mean, I think I know more about this than most people.
I am sure you do.
I know when to curb myself. I don't know enough to say whether it was
fair
true
enough
or not. But based on what I know, which is a fair amount, I would say that premise is untrue.
All right. Explain to me. I asked you where you are on the political spectrum. You said you're conservative, but then you said you've tended to vote Democrat.
Yeah.
Is that true to this day? And the reason I ask is, one of the other things that we're told is that the Democratic Party has been committed to making life better for African Americans, for lifting them up, for all of the rhetoric we hear from an Al Sharpton, and all of the sort of the idealistic vision of whether it's Barack Obama or Michelle Obama, and that it's only through the Democratic Party that blacks have an opportunity to improve their life and to end whatever racism exists in America. And I want to know, it really doesn't even matter to me how you vote, but I do want to hear whether you think that critique of the political scene in which Democrats, the Democratic Party, by platform and by energy, is more helpful to and sympathetic of and will be better for the life of Democrats, for black people, for African Americans, or given today's world, do you feel that if there are African Americans who somehow are comfortable within the Republican Party, they are not guilty of treason, black treason of some kind, right, but you can understand what motivates them for good as well?
Yes. I'll give you a very short historical perspective because it was interesting. I've been involved in a lot of law school debates and college debates, and they're a lot of fun, but they've been diminishing over time because, unfortunately, our academy doesn't like to have diversity in thought anymore, so you don't get invited to these things. But with respect to your question, right now, Democrats must get at least 92% of the black vote, a robust black vote, in order to prevail in national elections. Without that, they can't win. So that's the political imperative. But let's look at whether or not the Democratic Party, and by the way, it took me a while to evolve to this. And again, it's really a matter of looking at the evidence. The reason why I no longer was a Democrat was a whole host of reasons. But I was at a debate at USC Law School a number of years ago. And it had to do with affirmative action, racial preferences. I took the position that everyone should be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, and that everyone should be admitted based on their qualifications without any kind of advantage or disadvantage on the basis of race, color, sex, anything. The professor took the opposite position, not the opposite position, but he was in favor of racial preferences in college admissions. When I first went to the debate, I was told I was going into what they called a hot LZ. In other words, the students were hostile to what they perceived my position was. At the conclusion of the debate, I won't say I won or anything, but a number of the black students, approximately 15 of them, came down there. It was kind of an amphitheater style room, came down to where my podium was and said, to the best of my recollection, as follows. You know, we had never heard what you said before. And it makes some sense, but how can we, as black students, support the Republican Party given its history toward blacks in this country? Now, keep in mind, Rabbi, these are individuals who went through 12 years of school, 4 years of undergrad, and are now in law school, and they said that. And my response was, it wasn't the Republican Party that opposed the 13th Amendment freeing the slaves. It wasn't the Republican Party that opposed the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal protection. It wasn't the Republican Party that opposed the 15th Amendment Voting Rights Act or all the host of Civil Rights Act in the 1860s and 70s. It wasn't the Republican Party that opposed Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican's, anti-lynching legislation. It wasn't the Republican Party that enforced Jim Crow in the South. It wasn't the Republican Party that opposed in greater measure the 1957 Civil Rights Act or the 1964 Civil Rights or the 65 Voting Rights Act or the 68 Fair Housing Act. It wasn't the Republican Party that had as its members George Wallace, Lester Maddox, or Orville Faubus. And they were stunned by that. They were completely oblivious to that history. Now, is the Republican Party perfect in that regard? No. But the Democratic Party has a lot more to answer for when it comes to race than does the Republican Party. And if you take a look at the policy prescriptions of the Democratic Party right now, and as they have been for the last 40 years, how has it improved the lot of the majority of black people? Republicans have been nowhere in power in Chicago, for example, for 90 years. In Baltimore, there hasn't been a Republican in 65 years. Same in Detroit. So the systems that are allegedly racist, the systems have been in place, put there by Democrats, operated by Democrats. They are responsible. And those places for blacks for a long time have not been the most hospitable places around. High crime rates, high unemployment rates. So I take a look at the approach of the Republicans. It's not perfect. Are there racists in the Republican Party? Sure. But I'd rather be in a party that has an opportunity to advance the prospect of blacks rather than a party that I have seen in my lifetime appear to take blacks for granted, but more often than not, make sure you stay in your place as a loyal member of the Democratic Party. Don't question anything. So for the prospect of advancement of blacks in this country, I don't think that the Democratic Party at this point, well, put it this way, I think they've got a lot to answer for. What do they offer blacks to advance the economic interests of blacks in this country?
So I can't have you on without asking you one question about the media. And, you know, you first came to my attention because I've seen you talk on television. And I was very, very impressed by you. But I do want to get your sense of the extent to which in some way, and again, I'm showing my bias here, Peter, I fear that the media, mainstream media, is complicit in pushing an agenda and a narrative. And, you know, on CNN, the comment was made that looting and burning, destruction of property, is not violence. And I'm a dinosaur, and I grow up in the civil rights movement, and I am enormously influenced and affected by the ethic of Martin Luther King and the notion that it will be non-violent protest and that, you know, we will go across a bridge or we'll sit in the middle of a street or we'll go to a Woolworth's lunch counter or we'll go to the front of a bus, but we'll never raise a hand. And if they beat us, they beat us. If they use hoses and they use water guns, fine, they'll beat us, but we will never act violently, not to property and not to person. In today's climate, it seems like those who are supporting and leading the civil rights movement of today are prepared to use violence and are reluctant to call out violence as opposed to peaceful protest, which again is innately and completely part of the American experience and is guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States. So I want to know the extent to which the media has either disappointed you or whether at times it has, you know, in some way pleased you. And I don't want to lead you, Peter, but I do want to have your sense of it.
I concur with everything you say. It hasn't just displeased me or disappointed me. Especially in the last few years, the media has, you know, they've gone off the deep end. Again, I'm 66 years old, so I've got a little bit of perspective. And, you know, I never even, when I was in my 20s or 30s, thought about the media as being biased in any sense. I mean, maybe in retrospect and looking back, I thought maybe they leaned a little bit left, but I didn't think it was significant. I thought they tried to call balls and strikes. That started to change gradually, but over the last 7-8 years, they've gone off a cliff. And now they are, I used to think that they were just being biased and distorting things. And maybe they got things wrong. Maybe out of good faith, they attempted to present the facts dispassionately and clearly, but got it wrong, because everybody can. Every profession gets something wrong. But the errors kept going in one direction only. Okay, when somebody keeps erring in one direction, that's not a mistake, that's bias. And now I have heard, put it this way, I've been involved or I've been in the background of a lot of stories where I knew precisely what happened. I was either involved in contract negotiations or I was involved in testifying before Congress on a particular piece of legislation, and I knew what the facts were because I was there. And I won't go into a long discussion about this. I can give you examples where after the event was over with, I go home, I watch television and see the report on it, and it has absolutely no bearing to what transpired. They are lying about things. It's clear that they're giving you untruths and that they know that they're untruths. And I know this because there have been occasions in which I have told them precisely what's happened, or I've been providing documents that show what happened, and they say something completely different. It's truly astonishing. That's something that had never occurred. At least I didn't know it. Maybe didn't know it, but it didn't occur before in my lifetime. The media is, it used to be a good force for justice and equality. It kept people, I thought, it kept people honest. Now it seems as if they've taken sides and it's hurting America. It's hurting individual Americans and it's fanning the flames of division. I think what many in the media, not all, but many in the media are doing these days is reprehensible, and it's not helping Americans.
Peter, this is the first time we've met, and I'm not able to sit across a table from you. We have to do this, you know, on Zoom. But I was impressed when I saw you and wasn't able to speak with you. I'm blown away by you. And I know there are going to be some people who say, oh, you got Uncle Tom on. And no matter what you say, it won't matter. I know there are a lot of other people, however, who will hear you and it'll at least give us pause before we're so sure about what's going on right now on the American scene. I'll say this again, as I said at the beginning. Injustice is intolerable in America. And there is no even playing field. By the way, Peter, there's no even playing field in life. That's just the way life is. But we want there to be a more even playing field. And if there are ways in which African Americans or people of color or any people, whether they're Asian, it doesn't matter. We want America to be as fair and as kind and as humane to every American as possible. And if there's ever a situation where an African American family is somehow victimized by the system, we all feel terrible. But I believe the way you describe it is the way I experience it. The American people are basically a good people. We have a fabulous system here. And it hurts me to think there are people who want to tear it down and don't understand that everything needs improvement. In the Jewish tradition, Peter, that's the rabbinic perspective. Everything in life needs improvement, even America. But you've been articulate, you've been thoughtful, you've let me probe everything in such a lovely, kind way. I hope if I need you, I can call you again. And I really hope, Peter, that at some point I get to meet you in person. In the meantime, the best to your wife and the best to your grown-up children. And I hope the coronavirus comes and goes and that one day we'll meet each other. But thank you for all this time and for all your insight, Peter. It was wonderful having you on.
Ditto. It was wonderful to be on. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to your viewership. And this has been, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You be well. Peter Kersenow, a distinguished member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. And again, a very thoughtful and wonderful human being. My thanks, as always, to our director, Sloan Copeland, and to the producer of In the News, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe and be well, my friends.